Hello and welcome to this special edition of Box Set Binge the Bible from Seven Vineyard. My name is Bern Leckie and I'm joined today by Claire Lynch.
Thank you for having me, Bern.
And we're here to talk about a special topic. Just before Easter, as we're recording this, we're thinking about the issue of why did Jesus die? It is a big question, and I'm not sure if we're going to cover all the possible angles of this in the time that anyone has available to listen. But let's have a go. Claire, I'm especially pleased to talk to you about this because you did a fantastic pair of talks.
Thank you, Ben.
For Seven Vineyard the last couple of weeks on how does Jesus save? And you quoted a writer in that, Elwin Brooks White, the writer of Charlotte's Web, saying that explaining a joke is like dissecting a frog.
Yes.
You understand it better, but the frog dies in the process.
Yeah.
Which I think is absolutely right and may be relevant to the idea of trying to dissect things that are in the Bible, which very often strike me as kind of wondrous and living, moving parts. And I wonder if sometimes the analysis that we do to try and get to how they work and then make deductions from that actually means that we're really not looking at the living thing anymore.
Yeah. We want to drill it down to the absolute detail and understand every little thing. And actually, sometimes we need to be willing to accept we can't. Some things are bigger than we can possibly imagine. And there's many more facets. And actually, there's beauty in the mystery. And God is so much bigger than we can imagine. So, yeah, we can't always drill it down to the exact detail. But it's about being able to hold these things in tension and seeing the beauty of that.
I think it might be worth just framing all of this at the beginning with different ways that people see faith. And certainly the different ways I've experienced that people see faith.
Yeah.
When I grew up in a church that was quite heavy on mystery. It was the Roman Catholic Church, and it was a beautiful collection of stories and symbols and involvements of the senses. It had a tradition, which it had only just tipped out of tradition of doing the mass in Latin. So so you would expect to go to church and not even understand everything that was being said, but they would hope to try and communicate everything through the symbols and through the imagery and the things that you'd walk through. And my grandmother really, really loved that church for its sense of awesomeness and presence. She felt a presence there, which she didn't feel in churches that she said were just sort of ordinary. And I really got that.
Absolutely.
But I think there was a certain amount of that where I thought, well, there's mystery, but I'd like to understand better.
Right, of course. Yeah, we need that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then we got to the, I was a teenager in the 80s and met people from different backgrounds because I went to a different kind of school. And also when I was 12 years old, went to Billy Graham.
Right.
I was there in Villa Park.
Fantastic.
With tens of thousands of people. And there was the clearest explanation for why Jesus was important.
Yeah.
And what it meant for Jesus to die on the cross. And I think this is a really important explanation that you focused on a lot in your talks.
Yeah.
Because it's become almost like the default, the main thing, the only thing, or perhaps you might see written in leaflets and tracts that tell the story in different kind of ways. But it's this particular story of what it meant for Jesus to die on the cross. So I think we need to unpack that. There's a lot of detail in it. Tell us more about what's technically known as penal substitutionary atonement.
Atonement.
What's the story?
Yeah. I mean, like you, Bern, as a teenager, I found this a helpful model. And actually, through this, I did, it helped me to understand that God was a God that loved me so much that he would do anything for me. And he was a God of justice. And it's built on the understanding that God is like a heavenly judge, and we are lawbreakers and sinners in the heavenly court. And for justice to be done, God is requires a punishment to be paid. And so when it comes to humans and our sin, that punishment is death. But because God is also loving, he instead chose to send Jesus to pay the penalty, to take the punishment for our sins so that we wouldn't need to. And therefore, we can be acceptable to God. We can be forgiven and welcomed into his family. And whilst there are some aspects of that that can be helpful, there are some other aspects that can be especially unhelpful to people, and often sometimes the reason why people don't want to know the God that we believe in as a God of love. One is that this idea portrays God as a father who would torture and kill his own son, which is not the nature and character of God that we would see in the Bible represented in Jesus, and also implies that God is only able to forgive if someone is punished, which actually looks more like a transaction than it does forgiveness. You know, if you hurt your husband or your friend and they say, I'll only forgive you if you repay me, or I'll only forgive you if you do this, you know, that doesn't really feel like forgiveness, and that won't build a loving, healthy relationship. Whereas, you know, our understanding from scripture is that God is a forgiving God. It's in his heart to forgive. So to imply that he can only forgive if a certain set of rules are met, that wouldn't fit with who we understand God to be. Also, this understanding that forgiveness comes from punishment is built on an understanding of a legal system that we don't have today. So this theory of atonement, this model of atonement, came about in about the 1500s with a chap who was a theologian called John Calvin, who was also a lawyer. And he was trying to make sense of the gospel of how Jesus saves, using an analogy from his time. For justice to be done, a punishment has to be made. And in those days, punishment meant torture or violence or even death. But of course, that's not how we understand justice in today's society. We send people to prison. We believe in the rehabilitation of offenders. We believe in restorative justice. And we believe that's God's heart. To kind of explain a way of Jesus saving us in a way that portrays God to be something that we would think is abhorrent in our society today doesn't fit. But also, you know, I think just talking about sin, I think this understanding that sin is such a big barrier, that it builds this barrier between us and God, that he is so pure and cannot look on us, or because our sin covers us, I think actually makes, dare I say it, a bigger thing of sin than is maybe actually the case. And what I mean by that is, obviously, I believe that God absolutely hates sin. Of course he does, because it hurts us, it damages us, it leads to death, it brings destruction. Of course God hates sin. But to say that God cannot look on us because of our sin would imply that his love is not strong enough, that his love is not strong enough to penetrate through that sin to come to us, that if a punishment has to be made before he can actually extend his forgiveness to us, actually, I think, gives a different understanding of sin. And the problem with that, when we believe that our sin is a barrier, it affects the way that we relate to God. So we relate to God in a distant way. We feel that God keeps himself distant. We maybe feel distant. We maybe hold shame. And we act in a way where we feel we can only come close to God when we have said we're sorry, when we've shown we're sorry, when we've made things right, rather than trusting in God's forgiveness and his grace and his goodness and what he's done. And, you know, so often we, when we think of God as predominantly judging, we may and think of sin as this the thing that is the biggest problem, then we can sometimes think that, that this whole thing is about a broken law that God is needing to be to punish. However, I think what we see in Jesus, this is about broken relationship that God is wanting to restore.
This idea that if we are in this state of having broken the law and and be unacceptable then to God, I wonder if we can find somewhere in the Bible a way of looking at that that maybe sort of relates to that and understands that, but also maybe sheds a bit more light on it. And I'm thinking about a psalm, the psalm that Jesus quoted.
Yes, yes.
Now, I think we'll probably save some of this to come back to by the end, because I think this would be a really good thing for us to kind of look through this together.
Yes.
But it certainly starts off with that feeling expressed by, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah, and that absolutely, people read that at face value, and it reinforces that belief. Oh my goodness, the Father turned his back on Jesus.
Yeah,
and you might think, well, he did that for good reason. He did that for me, but he turned his back on Jesus, and Jesus was alone. So it reinforces that belief that in our sin we are alone, and God is not with us, which I think is really sad, and also a misunderstanding of Scripture. And it, and it's not just for those of us that would consider ourselves Christians or relationship with God. I think for so many people who don't even step a foot in church, they think that God is someone who hates sin, who hates sinners. He wants to send people to hell. He's going to judge people. And there's this big barrier. And that's how they view God. And they we miss the heart of God when we have this perception and this understanding of those few words that Jesus said on the cross. The misunderstanding reinforces that thinking. So yes, Ben, I'd love to dig into that a little bit deeper.
Let's bookmark it and come back to Psalm 22, because if not penal substitution, then what?
Right.
Is there an alternative? And best of all, is there other alternatives from the Bible rather than just our opinions about how we'd prefer to think about it?
Yeah. I mean, it's wonderful, isn't it? I mean, I think for much of my life, I thought there was one way of describing how Jesus saves. That's what I was taught. Mm. And because we have this modern worldview way of thinking, often where we want to have things sewn up and have a, an absolute answer to a question, this fits nicely within a box, I didn't explore wider. And I realized, come to realize that there are so many different metaphors and analogies and pictures and imagery that we see in the Bible that in the past sometimes I conflated, I mixed them up and thought they were all talking about penal substitutionary atonement, but actually they're not. And when you begin to delve into them, they're very beautiful images of what it means to be in relationship with God and the benefits of being in that relationship.
So yes, are there any other ways of looking at this, especially ones that are in the Bible?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a whole array of different metaphors that we see that Paul and the other New Testament writers talk about. And essentially, they congregate around five spheres of public life in the ancient world. So we see metaphors about the world of commerce, so the buying and selling of like of slaves, so paying a price. We see it around worship. We see images of sacrifice. We see metaphors around relationship, so reconciliation and adoption. We see metaphors around the court of law, so justification. And then also the fifth one would be the battlefield, so victory. And, you know, in addition, all of those different metaphors can be seen within the backdrop of covenant, which underpins God's relationship with the nation of Israel throughout the story of the Bible. And, you know, each of these metaphors can be seen as benefits of being under that and within that covenant relationship with God. So, and then over the last 2,000 years, various people, theologians, church leaders, bishops have developed these metaphors and created other kind of models, if you like, of atonement or theories of atonement, ways of looking at the how that Jesus saves. And it's important to say, in terms of when we talk about atonement, we are actually talking about Jesus' life, his incarnation, his death, his resurrection, and his ascension, and how each of those has a part to play in bringing us into relationship with God. It's not just about Jesus' death. One of the ones in the first 1,000 years was the Christus Victor model of atonement, which really frames Jesus' death and resurrection in terms of cosmic conflict. So the conflict between God and the enemies of life, like death and sin and the devil, and how through Jesus' death and resurrection, he conquered and broke the power of death and sin and the devil through rising, through his death and his resurrection. And one of the suggestions by someone called Irenaeus talked about recapitulation, how in Adam, sin entered the world. But actually in Jesus, by Jesus becoming human, he actually, through his life and death and resurrection, was able to conquer the sin and death and the devil by being human and doing it for us. So that's one particular view. But also Irenaeus did not limit himself to one thinking of atonement either. He also suggested the ransom theory, which is taking the image of the slave market. So in first century Greco-Roman culture, slavery was very common. It was a normal part of society, and slaves would be in bondage and but could be freed from that with a price, with a ransom price. So this idea is that in Jesus's death, it's like we've been freed. It's like a price has been paid for our freedom. And you know, when we're talking about ransom theory, it's not just about what we're freed from, but it's what we then are freed to. It's both. So we're freed from slavery and being a slave to sin, and we're now belong to God. We're accepted and we're part of his family. It's the both and in that picture there.
This is fascinating, because it strikes me that the earliest Christians had the sense kind of right away to know that there's lots going on with Jesus's death and resurrection. It isn't just it was because of this. It was there was a lot going on, which makes it hard to get our heads fully around.
Yeah.
But to me, really interesting to look at this wondrous frog before we've dissected it to bits.
Yes.
And go,
yes,
look at all these weaving parts. Look at all the things that are that are making it alive, making it work. Yes.
And I've just mentioned just a couple, and there's many others throughout the last 2,000 years as well. And I think, you know, people in that ancient worldview for the first 1,500 years after Jesus was here, actually people were much happier with allegory and imagery and to not have to nail things down. And each of these images are often cross over in different ways as well.
I mean, some others that struck me just reading the Gospels again this week.
Yes.
Just how much is described that would have meant something to Romans, who knew nothing about this Jewish theology. People who had no interest in, you know, the history of the covenant and all the different things, and probably hadn't even prayed through many of the Psalms or anything. But there is this imagery that that Paul refers to in Colossians. He says, having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. That's nothing to do with penal substitutionary atonement.
No.
That's an image that I understand relates to the Romans and how the Romans wanted to use crucifixion. It wasn't unusual for violent rebels and people who were going to cause trouble to the ruling powers to be crucified. But the way Jesus was crucified shows that they were recognizing his claim and to be king of the Jews and a ruler in a region that they said, actually, no, we rule here. And so they had the cross, not just to kill people, but to raise them up to a position where everyone could see that their power was going to be drained away by Rome. This is what we do to leaders who oppose us. This is what we're going to do to take away your authority, to drain the hope away from your followers,
right,
that there's that this is a struggle worth carrying on. That's what people understood. And so to flip that round by rising from the dead, it's like that alone is the most powerful statement you can make. Bring it on. Anything. We're in this conflict about who's going to rule here. The what's the worst you could do? Crucifixion. Okay, right. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
And having disarmed the powers and authorities, which is which Jesus did by rising from the dead, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross.
So it's reversed it.
So it's a description of exactly what the Romans do, but flipped.
Yes. Yeah, that's great. Incredible.
I'm also struck by the reaction of the Roman centurion who's in the gospel stories, because he recognizes that the way Jesus died made him think this was the Son of God. Why would he do that? I did a bit of looking into stories that Roman soldiers would have known about. Okay, these aren't in the Bible, obviously, but but let's try and understand the culture. A guy called Livy wrote A History of Rome and recorded stories of a leader called Decius. He was one of two commanders who was in a vital battle for Rome that would influence the empire. And he had a dream. And in his dream, he had a vision that either him or one of his fellow commanders could secure the victory, but only at the cost of their own life. So they would have to go into battle, and they drew lots, and the lot fell on Decius, it says, the story goes. And off he went after making what's called a devotio, a devotion, spiritual devotion that engaged the gods and bound him and the enemy army to all be received together into the underworld.
Yeah.
And off he went into battle, gave his life. That was a supreme example of self-sacrifice in the service of the Republic. And not only did he do that, but his son did the same thing 45 years later, inspired by his father's example. So father and son going into battle and allied with the gods, winning for the cause. Those two Deciuses or Decii were legendary icons in the Roman world. And I cannot imagine for a moment that a Roman commander wouldn't have had that in mind when he was looking at a commander who said he was a king and said he was fighting a battle, going to the cross to complete that battle. And then seeing the skies darken and feeling an earthquake and all the other things that the gospel writers record happened at the time, and going, it looks like the gods in this.
Yeah.
I think that guy's who he said he was.
Yes. Yeah. Wow.
And so all of these pictures, I think, help me to recognize the extra dimensions of what was happening. How few people probably in the crowd were going, oh, I'm glad that he's paying the price for my sins.
Right.
But how many of them would have just gone, how amazing.
Yeah.
I'd also be suffering, because at the time they would think it's a loss if they'd been following Jesus. But come Sunday, it all turns around. And I can't imagine a bigger turnaround in the history of turnarounds, can you?
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, thanks for showing that, Bern. Just, seeing that other perception of different people from different perspectives and what it might mean for them. And it's so much more than what we assume. Fascinating.
Let's get back to the Psalms, though, because I think the Psalms might help us tie all of this together and give us something to reflect on.
I'm
struck by the whole of Jesus's life and ministry. He is engaging in conflict, like the conflict that isn't just between people, but he identifies the conflict that people have within themselves. When people want to do something, but they don't do it. When people have an idea, oh yeah, I want to follow you, Jesus. Okay, well, just sell all your stuff then. Oh, now I'm internally conflicted and I don't know what to do and I can't deal with that. Jesus was kind of identifying internal conflicts, identifying conflicts between people, as well as the conflicts that were between nations. And and before Jesus, it strikes me like the book in the Bible that covers this the most comprehensively is probably the Psalms. If you look at Psalm 2, that's about national conflicts. You know, why can't we do the things that we want to do because all these other nations? Psalm 3 gets into more personal conflict and how people just conflict with each other and bringing that to God. Why can't good things happen here? And then you get into Psalm 4 and 5 and it's about conflicts within a person. And it strikes me that the Psalms meet us where we are in terms of understanding that, you know, sin, the reason why sin is important is because suffering is important. We don't want suffering. I recognize that sometimes I cause suffering for myself and I cause it for other people. I don't want to admit that. I don't want that to be the last word in my life or overcome that. And the place in the Bible before Jesus' ministry where I can see that being done most often is in the Psalms. So let's look again at Psalm 22. The one that Jesus says on the cross, because it's tempting to look at that and say, "Oh yeah, sin is so bad it cuts us off from God." That's literally the story that gets told. It cuts us off. God can't look at us. Is that real, or is that just how the psalmist was expressing his feelings at the time? What do we get from the rest of the psalm?
It's interesting to think how the Psalms would have been, for the Jews, it would have been their prayer book. They would have known off by heart each of those Psalms, and they're there to help people articulate their heart to God. Psalm 22 is interesting, isn't it? Because it doesn't exist alone, and it's seen as the Messianic trilogy. So Psalm 22, 23 and 24 are seen together. Psalm 22 is about seeing God as Messiah. Psalm 23 is about God as shepherd, and 24, God as sovereign, as king. And it's fascinating, isn't it, that Psalm 22, when we're thinking about Messiah, begins with the very words that Jesus spoke on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? And ends with the last words that Jesus said, tetelestai, means it is finished. And then within that psalm, there are so many verses that the New Testament writers have picked out that correlate with Jesus's death on the cross there. You know, when he says he's thirsty, when he says the soldiers are surrounding him, the word for soldiers was often dogs, and that's what's in the Psalms, how they cast lots for his clothes. There's so many parallels between that psalm. And as you were saying, Bern, you know, was it that for Jesus it felt like God had forsaken him? Was it that he was taking on our humanity so much that he knows what it feels like to be separate from God? But also, some theologians suggest that actually when Jesus said those first few words of the psalm, that people listening would have known exactly what he meant. They'd have known that, he's referring to Psalm 22, because they knew that. And actually what Jesus was saying, you know that psalm about the Messiah? That's me. I am the fulfillment of that psalm right now. He was saying he is who he said he was all along. And so it's incredible.
Yes. And I think as you say, it's so woven into the whole of the gospel story, the whole story of Jesus's preparation and what happened before and at the cross. I think it's hard to escape that there is more relevance to this than just that idea of, oh, yeah, God couldn't look.
Right.
But let's just pursue the feeling of the psalmist. Let's follow it from their point of view through Psalm 22. So first one, why have you forsaken me? That's a clear statement. You have forsaken me. Verse 2, I cry out by day, but you don't answer. You don't answer. I find no rest. Yet you are enthroned as the Holy One. So there's a sort of recognition that God is up there and doing something. It's not like, oh, well, we're cut off and now I don't believe that you're there anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you are there. It's just, you can't look at me. Skip to verse 6. I am a worm, not a man. Yeah. My goodness. Scorned by everyone, despised by the people. So he's taken on.
Right.
Like it's twisting him up, like it's a sense of humanity. Like, who could look at me? Who would treat me as a man? And then looking at how people mock his faith, his trust in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him. Yeah. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. You're right. People were saying that on the cross. That would be the sign. Show us, Jesus. Mm. Show us. Mm. Right, so Jesus is walking this through. It's clearly walking this through. Yeah. And what's the hinge then? What changes? I think you start to see it then when the psalmist reflects and remembers what he remembers about God. He brought me out of the womb. I wouldn't have had life, you know, but now I have life. You're the life giver who brought me out of the womb. From birth I was cast on you. Don't be far from me. It's still a negotiation now.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Back into, we're like that, aren't we? We go, God.
It's like, you can't look at me. Oh, but I'm still talking to you.
but I know you're good. But this is what I'm experiencing. But how often do we feel in that situation? Sometimes when we don't feel we have an answer to our prayers, but we do know that God said you hold on to what you know, but what you feel might be different.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, if the psalmist had really believed that God was gone, why is there anything more than the first verse?
Right.
Why have you forsaken me? I'm just going to carry on talking. No, clearly it's carrying on. He's putting his case. He's describing his situation. He's pleading with God. You, Lord, verse 19, do not be far from me. You are my strength. This is this is turning it around, isn't it? This is not saying I'm a worm anymore. This is saying, well, with you, I am. Yeah. That's who I am. With you, you are my strength. So, what do I expect from that? I actually expect to deliver me, rescue me. Yeah. I will declare your name.
Yeah.
This hope, it's almost like a kindling of a fire, isn't it? That you can see it sort of, it could have looked like it had gone out, but actually stoke it a bit and there it is. It's still alive, and the more it's kindled, the more it's visible, and the more it's obvious that it never went out. It can't have gone out because here it is. It's fully ablaze. By the time you get to verse 27, all the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him. Why has he got that hope? Well, I think the thing that really, really nails this, actually, we just skipped over verse 24.
We have. And this is the bit we really want people to remember, isn't it?
For he has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one.
Absolutely.
He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. That's what this psalm is about.
Incredible. So the exact opposites. It's the opposite. It's why have you forsaken me? And he's saying, he has not. He has listened to his cry for help, has not turned his face. Isn't that incredible how we, by not understanding fully the text, we can completely misunderstand something about who God is and that how that affects us.
Yes.
But he has not turned his face. Incredible. Incredible.
So I think this is a good place to land here. Yeah. I guess we've gone from, is it all mystery and we can't understand, so we put it in a mystery box, to now we want to understand, here's a simple explanation we can grab, but it's doesn't feel quite right. It certainly doesn't feel quite right by itself. Mm. It might just give us that distorted view of God if that's the what we just say, this is what it is.
Mm.
And now I think we've got on to by looking at the source and just looking at the Bible here, I think we've got a much fuller understanding of what Jesus meant when he said what he said on the cross. So I wonder if today would be a good day to pray this through. Have a read, have a pray, make some time and space to go through Psalm 22 with God. Mm. Maybe you might come and join us at one of our Easter gatherings and have a chat through, and maybe a pray with someone else too. But what I take from this is there is pain in life. You didn't need to tell me, I guess. There is pain in life. There are battles. There are struggles. There are things that you might be going through, that I might be going through within myself or with other people, or looking at big things in the world. But in none of these things are we alone. All of these things, I think we'll find through Psalm 22, God is with us at every step. And I wonder where we might find ourselves, where we might most easily relate to something in Psalm 22. Can we latch onto that and then follow it through to the end to see where God's taking us?
Yes.
I'd love to hear how that goes. If you want to drop us a line and if you'd like to subscribe or follow and listen to the rest of our podcasts as we're going through the Bible together in a year, we'll cover the whole thing. So we're going to come back to Psalms and other things later.
Wonderful.
But we'll see you again next time.
Thank you, Ben. Bye.